Welcome to Scream Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Scream Therapy. You're listening to episode 130.5 of the Scream Therapy podcast, a recap of the past 10 episodes, with people who link their involvement in the punk rock scene with their mental health. With each of these conversations, I learn more about how to maintain stability while living with mental health conditions that I have to manage every day. Just like the peer support groups I'm part of, talking to other punks about their lived experiences has been instrumental in my health. My hope is that you, the listener, will feel inspired and supported by the stories in these episodes. On episode 121, I welcomed the Carolins, Andrew Patrick, to talk about his lifelong fascination with punk rock. Andrew explained how being part of the punk scene has brought him meaningful friendships and the permission to make music on his own terms.
I feel like people say this kind of stuff all the time about punk, but it's so true. It's chosen family, you know? And the cool thing about what we do is you get to travel and see people that you normally wouldn't see. And then when you see them at a festival or another show, it's like you pick up right where you left off. I definitely say like the most meaningful relationships that I still have in my life have been forged through music, for sure. This music resonated with me more so than anything else. And don't get me wrong, like I was into a ton of stuff at a semi-early age, I guess. I loved metal and hip-hop and dance music, but punk was the constant in my life, for lack of a better term. I hope young bands continue to like carry the torch and people still keep it going, because it's just been such a defining part of my life.
Folk punk singer-songwriter Black Guy Fox came onto episode 122 to talk about being bullied in school. Fox lives with trauma around his youth and the harassment he's also faced in his adult life.
I remember this vividly. My freshman year, I was pulled into our vice principal's office or student affairs officer or whatever, and I was asked about if I had a hit list, because people made a rumor that I was going to shoot up at school. And I had my locker searched through. I heard people come up to me in school, ask me what's going on, or just being really nosy about it. And I was kicked out for about being 3 days while I had my mom go up and just try to convince them to let me back in. Just surely these things are not true at all. And there's no actual repercussion for the kids that were like perpetuating this. So there was stuff like that. I remember I've been pushing the mud. I had money stolen from me. My first ever acoustic Ibanez, I remember that was stolen from me like my sophomore year of high school. And I remember kids thought it was a game, and I remember them calling me saying if I did not pay them $500 and they're going to destroy it. It was the fact that there's nobody in the school who would actually do anything about it. It was just always boys will be boys. And well, on that end, I was suffering quite a good bit. And because of my mental health as well at that point, like I was doing bad. So I wasn't turning in homework. I just want to make friends, but I was failing in school because of that. My junior year, I remember my mom actually took me to therapy sessions like a small bit of time. Like it was only for me like 3 or 4 weeks. And I was not taking it seriously at that point, because I was just telling myself, I don't want to be here. I feel like there's something wrong with me. I feel like I need to. So I just kind of faked saying, hey, I'm doing better now, even though I really wasn't.
Matt Arbogast of The Gunshy guested on episode 123. The punk scene accepted Matt at an early age and without judgment. Although he doesn't play traditional punk rock, leaning into the indie Americana scene, Matt is inspired by the freedom he felt as a youth. He'll always consider the DIY punk scene to be his home.
Even to an extent now, but early on, a lot of those shows were very much a purge, like you're saying. Like, I toured solo a lot, but even then, I was breaking strings and just bleeding on my guitar and just a release in a way that I never felt comfortable doing at home. I was able to go and do this thing, and the reception was very much appreciative and welcoming, instead of being done and feeling like, oh man, I just made things weird for everybody. that was such a relief to be like, okay, it is okay to do this. This kind of self-expression is welcome. that just kind of went from there, and that allowed me to just kind of feel, I don't know if confident would be the right word, but at least accepted, and people were happy to see me the next time I came back, and all this. It just flourished all these like very strong, natural relationships with people all around the country, and it just really kept me rolling along.
Comedian and arson charge screamer Ben Roy joined me on episode 124. Ben talked about how the sexual abuse he experienced as a child shaped his adult life. Punk rock and comedy were places where Ben had permission and was encouraged to speak out. Over time, he has learned ways to process the pain of his past through expression.
Part of the story of what had happened to me is that when I was 10, I told my parents what had happened. But their reaction was so... I just belted out some stuff that had happened while we were eating a dinner. And I was 10, and I saw the reaction on my parents' face, and I realized, oh, this is a big deal. And my parents didn't know what to do. The church was everything. And there wasn't an open dialogue in the 80s about this kind of abuse. The church scandal hadn't really broken at that point. So my parents didn't know what to do. So they just sort of froze, and they opted to like not do anything. And I think from that point on, my mental health just fluctuated a lot more after that for a lot of other reasons. But I think it's also important in the context of my own personal journey through this, that time, you know, I'm 46 years old. The conversation wasn't as open about it back then, you know, and especially in religious communities. You didn't dare poke the Catholic Church.
Episode 125 featured male gaze guitarist Hank Atherton. Hank talked about the link between creativity and depression. When faced with times where he felt unable to create music or be in a band, Hank found himself in darkness and isolation. Over the years, he has realized how important music has been to his mental health.
The way my brain operates is best under structure, which is why I went back to public school. I think like having an hour a day is like a good way of going about it. And sometimes it's really, really hard to even like conceptualize a free hour in the day when you are so busy just trying to survive. I'm still struggling with that, like to this day. That struggle is real, but like when you can find that time, it's really useful. And even if, I don't know, the hard thing is just the guilt around taking time for yourself when you should be, again, big air quotes, doing other things. Because there is like a guilt to it for me. And I don't know if that's like universal, but that seems like a thing, like, especially in American society, of like, you should be working until you die.
Nate Worrell of UK hardcore band Going Off was the guest on episode 126. Nate reflected on receiving an ADHD diagnosis. He explained that acceptance and knowledge of his condition were keys to his mental health. Newly medicated, Nate said he's been able to better manage his swirling thoughts.
One thing that I've always struggled with, which led me to think that I was ADHD, even in school, like some of the teachers were like, we think you might have ADHD. And I like told my parents, and my mum was like, no, you're too smart, it's fine. So I just coped for 20 years. But yeah, one thing that I struggle with is the noise in my head. I can only describe it as there's like thousands of bees in there. I can just like hear, say if there's too many noises or conversations going on at one time, that absolutely like drives me insane. And I just get really overstimulated and quite irritable. And it's not a fun feeling, but since taking the medication, besides like getting used to the medication, like kind of the peaks and troughs of like moods and stuff like that, it's stopping that as much, which leads me to being less like kind of anxious.
On episode 127, Rob David of Death of Youth talked about living on the spectrum and how it's affected his music. Rob also reflected on how growing up with autism made him the target of bullies. The punk scene allowed him to open up and eventually feel comfortable being his authentic self.
I was diagnosed with autism around the age of 5 years old. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like the world is built for neurotypical people rather than neurodiverse people. So I have had to face a lot of scrutiny, especially when I was in school, from people who just didn't understand that. And because of that, I had a few years of really just trying to pretend that I wasn't autistic, just because I thought I was scared of how other people would perceive me. And it took me a good few years to realize actually the way I am is fine, and I shouldn't need to hide who I am to impress people who I shouldn't need to impress to begin with.
On episode 128, Nicole Morales of Hit Like a Girl talked about forming No More Dysphoria, an organization that raises funds for trans people in need. Nicole explained how being part of the punk scene and putting on shows and playing in bands allowed them to take the next step towards helping others.
My favorite success story for the organization is healthcare is cheaper in other countries. That's definitely not a secret. So someone from Puerto Rico reached out expressing that he wanted to get top surgery, and it's a lot cheaper there than it is in the States. So we were able to fund his entire top surgery. But it is a big, amazing feat. But also, if that was in America, there's just like no way we would be able to afford to do that. I guess it's hard to put into words how it feels to live in a world or in a society that actively works so hard to erase you. It's really hard to put into words how it feels to like live day to day not being your truest, most authentic self. And it really is a shame that anybody ever has to live that way. So any small thing I can do to help someone just feel 1% more comfortable in their own body is something I definitely want to do, because that is the worst feeling in the world, just living in shame or hiding or whatever it is. And no one should have to live like that, especially like in today's political climate.
Nick Wood of UK melodic punk bands Tired of Fighting and Blame Yourself came on to episode 129 to talk about the emotional pain of suicidal ideation. Nick has faced the lowest of lows and come out the other side, using music as a way to channel his struggles and triumphs.
I tried to kill myself when I was 24. I overdosed, and I was in the doctor's office, and we'd done the bloods and stuff. And he said, if you don't take this treatment, then you're going to die in 2 days. And he said, do you want to take the treatment? It was that moment where it should have been, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. I've made an awful thing. Life is worth living. And this was just no reaction. And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, why do you want to kill yourself? And I said, because I don't think life's ever going to get better. I don't think I'm ever going to feel better. And he said, that's not true. And my immediate thought was, you're lying. You're lying to me. And that's messed up. That is an ill thought process. There are literally human beings out there who think that these things don't exist. And to them, I would say, Exhibit A, the thing that I went through.
And finally, on episode 130, I welcomed Chris Hyde of folk punk band Pit Props to discuss telling stories of mental health through music, film, and poetry. After years of playing punk rock, Chris found himself in the world of independent film. He also talked about how he's been able to harness his anxiety to do his creative and organizational work.
It was that transition where I didn't have a band, and I was like, I'm just going to write the lyrics the same, and I'm just going to go on stage and read them. And share them. So I did that, and it was great. And I was kind of doing spoken word poetry. Also, I didn't kind of know I was doing that. And I got into doing that, and then I realized that for me, the love of writing it and sharing it was like a huge, huge important part, and that different modes of doing that served me in a similar way. So through writing poems, and it was lyrics, the poems, and then I got this opportunity. Someone asked me, they saw me do a poem in a bar, which I always like to share that, of like, go out and do the thing. I'm pretty sure I was like, I don't know if I want to go to this open mic. Someone was like, hey, that was a pretty visual piece of writing. Have you ever thought about making films? And I was like, no, not at all, but sounds cool. And they literally just text me, like, they got my number and they text me an opportunity, and I applied for it because I was like, that sounds good. I'm not doing anything else. So I got into filmmaking, like, really, like, through doing what I'd always done, which is gone to bars and kind of shared what I had to say. And then there was this really cool way of being able to like create a whole little world.
I encourage you to go back and listen to these full episodes and many more at screentherapyhq.com. As you can imagine, Doing scream therapy for the better part of 6 years can be taxing. Every so often, I like to take a break and do some episodes of Flex Your Head, where I talk about classic punk albums with one of my good friends. Scream Therapy will return soon enough. In the meantime, join me for the next few episodes of Flex Your Head. For a taste of what's to come, check out this clip from a previous Flex Your Head episode. On this one, I dissect Fugazi's first two EPs, 13 songs, with my guest co-host, Nelson from Nelson. So what album are we talking about today?
We are talking about the fantastic 13 songs by Fugazi.
Fugazi was formed in Washington, D.C. in 1986 by guitarist and vocalist Ian MacKay, vocalist Guy Picciotto, bassist Joe Lally, and drummer Brendan Canty. The 13 songs release is a combination of the Fugazi EP, which came out in 1988, 6 songs, and Margin Walker, which came out in 1989, 7 songs. And the band toured in January 1988 before the first EP even came out, so they came into these recordings as a live touring band already. And the Margin Walker EP was recorded in England with John Loder, who is involved with Southern Records, and that was recorded in 1988. So a lot's going on here, but basically the long and short of it is this is Fugazi's first 2 appearances on the punk rock scene, and I think they really took the scene by storm in some ways, starting in locally and then kind of spreading out from there, obviously after the popularity of Minor Threat and to a lesser extent Rites of Spring. So let's start. What are your opening thoughts on the record after we spent the last, 2 weeks just pounding on it?
I know this album top to bottom, and like many significant albums in one's life, it takes me back to a time.
There was a lot of talk about Ian's new band. And when they came out of the gates with this one, he'd said that he wanted to do a band, quote, like the Stooges with reggae. And that was in Michael Azerrad's Our Band Could Be Your Life book. Yeah, it's got a real swing to it. I know they were influenced quite a bit by go-go music out of Washington as well. But style-wise, I know you're into all kinds of punk styles and metal styles. How did you feel about it the first time you heard it?
I knew it was punk rock, but it was something quite different, especially Joe Lally, the way his bass was really in the foreground was quite unusual for punk rock. Their breakdowns, they had a lot of dissonance and feedback, like Sonic Youth, another band who I really love. So pretty instantly I was drawn in. My friend had a picture that he took of Ian swinging his SG towards his amplifier, his Marshall amp. And I was like, this is a band I really got to see, which thankfully I did once.
I got to say right off the bat, they're my favorite band of all time. I've been doing a deep dive around the live series that they have online on Discord Records website.
Yep. Fantastic.
Kind of become an obsession. In fact, let's just say it is an obsession, listening to way too many of those things. There's so much improvisation with this band, and on this particular record, even though they sounded like maybe a little bit, let's say, more stripped down than their later stuff, there is always that really cool improvisation.
Yeah.
I've been listening to it since I was a kid, and there's things that I didn't really realize at the time. You know, you grow with a band, and you come back to it later in life and realize, oh, wait a second, oh, that song was about that, or, oh, they're doing that thing with their guitars right there. But I do remember getting the album when I was in my first year of college and just being blown away by, like you said, how different it was for punk. I guess No Means No was another one that was very different in that way, but yeah, what a band.
Also their politics and how they never charge sort of more than $10 per show. Their ideology really shaped me as a person as well. Sticking to your guns, not being a sellout. They really shaped my young mind because, when that album came out, I would have been 18, 19. They also really practice what they preach. That was a really important life lesson.
Let's talk a bit more about the album proper. 13 songs, obviously, 6 of them on the EP and 7 on the second EP. The first EP
is pure Fugazi. It's the production is so warm and awesome, and the songs are amazing. They're the key songs from the band's catalog, and I guess considered their most infamous songs through their whole career. The second EP is a little bit strange. It was recorded with isolated tracks, so it's got a bit of a colder feel. Cold's not the right word. A bit more of a robotic, in some ways, feel. And the songs are amazing. But I always wondered if they recorded all 13 songs in that one session or gone back to DC to record an inner ear again for the second session, what it would have sounded like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, of course, the first, I always view the album as sort of two halves, but the Waiting Room has such a distinctive opening to it and just a slow burn. It's now a certified punk classic for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great entry into a fantastic album. It just draws you in, even if you're not familiar with the band. Their choice of instrumentation just kind of reels you in. You're like, oh, what's going to happen next?
I heard on a podcast called The Alphabetical Fugazi, which is one of my favorite podcasts, that dissects Fugazi songs from A to Z.
Nice.
There's an episode at the very end of the podcast, because when he's done the alphabet, he's done, and he brings on Ian MacKay and Picciotto, and they talk about that the band's songs, kind of the inside workings. And Ian was saying that, I guess they came back to some of the recordings for Margin Walker afterwards and were a little bit curious about some of the ways that John Loder had done the recording. And they found out that the drums aren't always Brendan Canty, that a lot of times they're click tracks.
Oh.
If you go back and listen to it, you can hear that really, you know, the metronome style.
Oh, interesting.
Which gives me a whole new perspective on it, because as soon as you're told something about a particular album, hey, the bass player's playing with six strings or whatever, you can all of a sudden listen and hear it, right? And listen back on it, because it's very strange. I'll throw a clip in so that people can hear quite how cold the drum sound is, which is such a shame because he's such an amazing drummer. Let's talk about some of the songs. You mentioned Waiting Room, obviously one of the most iconic punk songs of all time. That pause that we heard before, it stops on the dime.
Such an exciting song. Yeah. And next was Bulldog Front, which starts with, again, Feedback. I think Feedback's one of my favorite sounds in the whole world. I've probably done a lot of hearing damage listening and recreating it, but just the kind of yelly chorus, you want to figure it out. Yeah, I really, really love that.
I was thinking about this the other day when listening to it. I was never really a huge dubstep or electronic music fan. I kind of liked it just out of curiosity and just from being an outsider with it. But there's a lot of those kinds of drops in this album, like the very beginning of Badmouth just drops in. Badmouth is probably, if not my favorite song on the record, definitely in the top three.
Yeah, again, Joe Lally, the bass player, he's so important to the band's sound. And the way it's mixed, his bass tracks are very upfront. Typically, the bass is kind of in the back, sort of behind the guitars and the vocals, but it's very forward. Touched on before, like kind of reggae, where it's kind of a lead instrument almost.
They did move away from that sound fairly quickly. Repeater, which is the album that came out after this, was basically their first official album. It had a little bit of that reggae sort of tinge, but it was basically a straight-up punk record, or post-hardcore, I guess you could say. This one presented that sound and then kind of slowly filtered away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's some really cool things, like the song Burning, which is the fourth song on the album, has that drum rim clicks through the whole song.
There's a heavy reverb on the drums, more of like a hair metal rock drum sound, which again, is not a typical punk thing. In punk, like, you have no reverb on the drums. It's a very harsh pop. The snare has to pop and that's it, but it's a very rock sounding drums and it sounds great.
What's your opinion on the infamous bell that he uses?
It's awesome. It's, I mean, now it's become like an old friend and you kind of wait for it. It's like, oh, here it comes.
Yeah, because there is one or two bell hits on this one. And then you listen to them live and he throws that in when you're least expecting it, really, and it's so cool. I guess the story there is that they had found that bell in some sort of an antique shop and grabbed it for him, just almost, not as a joke, but like, hey, check this out. You could put this in your drum setup. It's this huge bell from a ship. So I'm so glad they found that.
Yeah, it's a nice little touch for sure.
On suggestion, I like how there's that hard cut at the end where he screams guilty and then it just stops.
Mm-hmm.
They had some really experimental stuff on later albums, but even this is the very first recordings they did, and they've got a lot of stuff that no other band had done before, really.
Yeah, definitely. Punk, like any sort of a genre, can get sort of stuck. You have to have a dry snare, shouty vocals, and they touched on some of those, but they also expanded it.
And there's not very many bar chords on this.
No.
Because bar chords are a staple of punk rock, right? I mean, you think of Ramones, all it is bar chords. You're more of a guitar guy than I am, but there's a lot of strummed minor chords and there's not a lot of just straight up bar chords.
Yeah, exactly.
Interested to hear what you think about the fact that on the first EP they had that, you know, warmer sound, and on the second EP, how do you hear those differently? Because when I first got the record when I was a kid, I didn't even think. I just assumed this was an album of 13 songs. I didn't know they were two different things, but how do you see the differences between the two?
Yeah. It's kind of a record has two sides. It sounds like the same band, but you can really hear both a progression in their songwriting. I agree with you 100%. The recording of the second album is so different than the first. I don't know if the band was ever really happy how the album worked as a whole, because usually you want an album of 13 songs, say, to really be cohesive, and the two of them are quite different.
Tackling Fugazi lyrics is almost as intimidating as tackling Minor Threat lyrics. Very different style and more not as overt in the way that Minor Threat was. And a lot of the lyrics are, I don't want to say poetic, but they have deeper meaning. And
mm-hmm.
But the thing that sticks out right away for me is, talked about Suggestion before, obviously very powerful lyrics on that one. But you know, there's so many great lines on this record. I don't know if you wrote any notes about particular lines.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I've got this one from Provisional. That's the price you pay for hoping every slip's not a slide. Somewhere in these private minds, the left will come just in time to clear out the chambers, sew up the limbs. That's the price you pay for hoping every slip's not a slide. For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to ScreenTherapyHQ.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to ScreenTherapyHQ.com. For merch, check out ScreenTherapy.threadless.com. Okay, enough promoting. It's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Screen Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at ScreenTherapyHQ.com or email me at ScreenTherapyPodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
One more thing before your interview. Can I have your address, please?
I live on Main Street.
I need your exact address.
I live on Main Street.
Oh.
No job, no home. And no home, no job. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Hi,